the tension to it, as it turns out, is that people read that and go, ah, it's everybody except me, right? Yeah. I don't... this doesn't...
Hello and welcome to episode 142 of Rockstar CMO FM. The M is for marketing and the F is for well you decide. As you're probably wondering, does the world need another effing marketing podcast? I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm no rock star, but I picked up a thing or two over the last 20 years on my tour from sysadmin to CMO, and on this weekly podcast, I chat to the true rock stars, my fabulous guests and chums, to share some marketing street knowledge that will hopefully inspire your inner rock star. Come say hello, just search for Rockstar CMO, and you'll find it. It's Saturday, the 26th of November. If you're in the US, I hope you've enjoyed the Thanksgiving holiday, and to all of you, thank you for listening. I hope you've had a good week, and you are staying as sane as you feel you need to be. In this week's episode, I asked Jeff Clark if we should give thanks or no thanks on a bunch of marketing topics. I go backstage and marketing leader and former vice president demand marketing at Forrester, Alyssa Grucock. And we wind down the week in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar with Robert Rose for a Thanksgiving cocktail. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On to our first segment, the Marketing Studio with Jeff Clark, our resident rockstar CMO advisor. And to celebrate the season, I try and invent a new game. Thanks or no thanks. Ian, come on into the studio.
Thanks, mate. It's nice to be again. And
you know, I'm just going to say apologies for the Go USA soccer banner that I have up here.
That's perfectly all right, mate. I'm sure that all of that will be resolved in a few hours.
In a few hours, as a matter of fact, it will be. And yes, and both my son and I will be watching the game and texting back and forth. And actually, my neighbor, who is from, here in Amherst, Massachusetts, my neighbor is actually from Scotland. And wow. You know, when you ever ask him about, you know, what he wants to see happen in any kind of match, yeah. He says, as long as England loses, I'm fine.
Well, then, yes. Well, and for the people that, well, you people, I mean, listener, you're listening to this on Saturday, and this is being recorded on Friday before the big match between the US and England in the World Cup. So best of luck.
Yes, Jeff. And it could determine who gets out of the group now that Iran has beaten Wales. And
They have indeed. Yeah, yeah. But also, you're absolutely right about Scottish supporters. They do not like the English, and we'll go for anybody else. Although Liz, who is in my little midweek mini-series. Yeah. I was quite surprised by her on Wednesday. She's been watching the England games, and she is, in fact, Scottish herself. So that you can't say every Scottish.
You can't say. Although one time we were watching England play Italy in a bar in Edinburgh, yeah, and to cheer for England was like, the stares that you would get would be like, yeah, get out of this bar.
Yes, you would not do that. Yeah. All right, so, but we're not here for this dreadful tribalism that is football. We're here to give thanks on Thanksgiving. So we're recording this the day after Thanksgiving, so I'm especially thankful to you anyway for all the time you've given to the podcast.
But and I'm thankful for you and giving me a platform and and for, since you're British and don't have any you guys don't celebrate this, I'm thankful that you're recognizing it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's also Indigenous People's Day here in the US as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, but, yes.
What Anyway. Well, the other thing we've inherited from you guys is today is also Black Friday for us. So apparently I'm supposed to be on Amazon or something like that, yes, buying everything. But so thank you for that. All right. So as I enter the studio and we are going to do we eat pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving? We do.
Oh, that, yes, so, absolutely. Yeah.
So we've got a studio full of pumpkin pie. But I had an idea for a Thanksgiving game, although I am in no place to make up Thanksgiving games, as you pointed out, because it's not my culture. But I was thinking that today we might just have a little casual chat, and I thought we'd give thanks or no thanks to a bunch of topics that we've been talking about. So what I want to do with you, Jeff, I was going to use the word quickfire, but I don't think anything you can describe us doing as
is quick. No.
but I thought I'd give you a bunch of topics and ask you whether we should give thanks or not to some of the things we've been discussing this year.
Absolutely. And I would appreciate your opinions on this as well, on these topics.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. My God. I think you might be a bit fuzzy from all the eggnog. Giving me a chance? What? All right, buddy. So the first one is, do you want to give thanks or no thanks to the changes that are happening with cookies at the moment?
I would say no thanks. And you know, partially because it's like, you know, the changes are purely because, you know, the platforms like Google are saying, you know, we want to have a new way of, yeah, you know, of tracking data and understanding who's who. And so it complicates things for us as marketers, for companies, mm-hmm, you know, when their websites and managing it. And, you know, I'm all for the ability to identify people specifically, protect privacy, you know, et cetera. Yeah. And I think the changes just, you know, kind of throw everything up in the air and it'll likely settle down. So in 5 years, we won't be complaining about it or anything like that. But I think for the time being, it's just a play on the part of the platforms to take over.
Yeah, do you think it's just a bit of privacy theater in a way?
That
it doesn't actually advance the topic of privacy.
It does not advance it at all, at least from my perspective. And then it's like that could be to be determined, if you will.
Yeah. I did have a guest a few weeks ago who was talking about this in terms of the swimming pool, and what they wanted to chuck in was all the sort of hype around cookies and the fact that everybody has to have a cookie banner regardless of the law of where you are. So, and that's when I was thinking about this whole idea of it is just privacy theatre, isn't it? What's really going on and what's going to change? So cookie changes, no thanks.
No thanks.
It's really about no thanks to cookies. We do want some changes, but not the ones they're doing. Next up, social media, thanks or no thanks. And I know that's a really broad topic, Jeff.
That's a broad topic.
But it's been in the news a lot this year about the different channels that are coming on and what's been going on in the world. So I thought I'd ask you, what do you think from a marketing perspective?
From a marketer's perspective, I would say, I should answer this in two ways. I'm going to first answer from the marketer's perspective and then from the consumer's perspective. I mean, from a marketer's perspective, I think, you know, it certainly, it adds channels of engaging with customers and, you know, projecting, you know, your brand and, you know, getting, you know, your own customers perhaps to, you know, interact with each other or comment. Certainly from, you know, we were involved in, you know, a company that did some social media intelligence gathering. And so there's just like so much great information you can get by understanding people's commentary, likes, dislikes, engagement, etc. And so I think it definitely adds something. And certainly, you know, depending on your audience, you know, something like a LinkedIn, you know, is just a great channel for really targeting a specific group of people and, you know, not necessarily being in a, you know, in a quagmire like Facebook you know, just because it's very well moderated and regulated. You know, as a consumer, you know, I have to say I've taken myself off so many of the social media challenges, except for LinkedIn. I actually still am on Twitter as well, but my use of it has gone down just because of all of the, you know, the cesspool of stuff that it has enabled. And so therefore you got to do the balancing is like, okay, is the fact that I could see, you know, pictures from, you know, my cousins, grandkids and things like that, is that, you know, how's that and compared to, you know, the damage it's been doing to, you know, frankly, to democracies around the world.
Yeah. I think it's a shame because, and also right now, it's no, you know, most of these channels are no longer really, it's not about social media and connecting people. It's more about content curation and distribution of ads and stuff, isn't it?
And the platform's making tons of money, both on the advertising and on the leveraging our data. And then where our data goes, you know, is out of, I mean, it's just not controlled, you know, certainly outside of the European Union.
It's an amazing, really, the unforeseen circumstances, I think, that have come about from social media. So, no thanks. I got a sense there, no social media from a user's perspective. But I think there's a thanks there for marketers. It's just there is this sort of specter, isn't there, of darkness over it. And it could be, but the world could be so much better than it really is.
And I think that then that behooves us as marketers to make sure we're doing our own job on moderating content we put out and tracking what content that you know, other people out there in the social media sphere are appending to to our content. So it certainly it's something it requires to do it right. It requires time and effort. And so if you've got a customer base that is active on social media, then you've got to be there. There's just no question about it.
Yeah. Perhaps shouldn't have thrown this one in. It's a bit of a bigger topic, isn't it? A bit of social media in general, but
we can build on this on 2023.
Thanks and no thanks. No. But then specifically to what you're alluding to there, do we give thanks or no thanks to the unraveling of Twitter right now? What's going on Twitter?
Well, it probably depends on whether you want it to survive or not. if you don't want it to survive, it's probably say give thanks. I think this is, this is an area where I just find it fascinating because, you know, one is you've got a guy in Elon Musk who's been very successful in a couple of ventures. That are primarily engineering and manufacturing ventures, and then he delves into the area of social media. And I've heard people make very good cases that this is really, it's not as much about the technology, it's more about the moderation and how you enable people to use the platform. And I think some of his instincts, as I understand it, going in terms of getting rid of the bots and the bad actors, from a technology perspective, are probably good. I think within this case particularly, it's a fascinating case study in how to not do transformation in an organization. I mean, to kind of come in, fire half the staff, make the other half want to leave and just start like implementing ideas that, he's thought through, but you've got an organization of thousands of people that have got to, weigh in on managing all that. And I'm not sure. Actually, I heard a great analogy is that this is like somebody who really likes Oreo cookies saying, I'm going to buy Oreo cookies and I'm going to make a better Oreo. But I've never really been in the food processing business and I don't know how to bake. I just, I just have all these ideas. And, so I think
that's probably one of the nicer analogies I've
had. But I think the fact that Twitter is like so important to people in, news media. And I know, it's like one of the fastest ways if you're trying to find the news on something that doesn't hit. Any news websites or on the TV or the radio or anything like that. It's one of the fastest ways to find out what's going on about something. Absolutely. So it has got a purpose, and it doesn't make money. So, more power to Elon for figuring out how to make it successful, he's not doing a good job yet.
No, I agree with you. Well, I mean, there's a lot more qualified spectators. Commentators than me on this stuff, but I agree with you. I think that some of the things that Elon's thinking about and his motivations seem to be good ones, like the company needs to be the right size, it needs to make money, there are certain things that need to change and be done. But the whole way around of doing it is just, as you say, it's a case study in chaos, right? It's just crazy. And so, but I would give thanks to Twitter because I feel like you just said, I think I've used it less and less over the last few years, but it's given me a lot of pleasure and it's made a lot of connections. And you read people being genuinely distraught at what's happening to this platform that they've liked. I mean, you would then refer back to various folks that say don't build things on rented land and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's you know, there's a responsibility, I think, of the platform that hasn't really been upheld. But anyway.
I would agree
so
with that.
So that's the unraveling of Twitter. So Twitter we generally give thanks to, but no thanks to.
No thanks to Mr. Musk. and I, you know, as somebody who is very interested in seeing the success of electric cars, I mean, he's definitely taken his eye off the ball in Tesla And not that Tesla's the, you know, the end-all and be-all to electric cars, but it's like if that goes down the tubes because he's fiddling around with Twitter, he has made a huge mistake.
I agree, but yes, absolutely. But I think fortunately the industry has moved on sufficiently that they're not the only game in town, right?
So, absolutely.
I do know a lot of their chargers and all that kind of stuff is technology that's presumably proprietary to them that they that they bring to the world. So I agree with you on that. But well, that would be a shame. So my fourth one for you, which is again another broad one. I'm going to bowl in your direction. Oh no, we should be making football analogies. It shouldn't be shoot it in your direction. Is marketing technology? Now the reason why I wanted to ask about marketing technology now. Quickfire, and nobody can see the air quotes that I'm putting around quickfire, is that it comes up so often on the show and with the guests and with us, and we talk about marketing technology all the time. So, I mean, I have to say, I have to give thanks to marketing technology. It's basically been my career.
Yes.
but marketing technology in general, Jeff, thanks or no thanks?
I guess I would have to join you in that saying thanks because it's been certainly been part of my career. I remember trying to solve marketing problems with technology back, years and years ago when, before marketing automation, I just think about all the ways we're trying to solve things. And certainly the technologists have come through with very big breakthroughs, but, you know, kind of as we were discussing before, you know, we started on this particular episode, it's like, you know, have there been any big breakthroughs like there were with the onset of CRM systems, market automation platforms, ad tech and data? Certainly, I mean, we've talked a number of times about things like, customer data platforms, and so there's a lot of things that probably, are 3-4 years old that have really, are improving the ability for marketers to do their work.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that certainly I saw back when I was tracking, the budget benchmarks was that the spend on marketing technology had really leveled off a couple of years ago. And that, it was like
30% of the marketing budget, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like going up and up and up, and then it kind of hits a plateau, which is likely a good thing because like overall spend on technology from a corporate perspective, it's like you get to a point where you realize you have to manage the whole ecosystem and you make one change here that has ripple effects and so managing the ecosystem. It becomes more important than getting the latest new tool.
Anything like that takes us off our eye off of all that management and stuff you're just talking about. Takes our eye off of the main goal of what we're here for, right? Which is marketing and demand generation.
So absolutely,
I think that's
absolutely. You really can't address the technology without addressing the processes that it's supporting. Yeah. Which is another downfall. And so sometimes it's like you really should be looking at how you're trying to improve your processes first before you pay that next big check to a MarTech vendor.
Okay, so thanks to marketing technology, but qualified Do you need
Yes,
it?
it's like exactly. Turkey, you know, you can only eat so much, so why buy a bigger turkey?
I love it. All right, and then on a related note, what do you think? Do you give thanks or no thanks to artificial intelligence?
I still think we're in the era of giving thanks. We may regret it someday when it kicks us out of the department. But I think, you know, I think it has improved, you know, certainly when we, as we were, you know, talked about customer data platforms, and certainly a lot of web technology, you know, digital asset management. I mean, so many of those things have been so improved by AI, and machine learning that, I think, you know, we have to continue to give thanks for it. And it does things that, you know, as opposed to like doing things that like, you know, enable you to let go of staff because you're doing things more efficiently. It really is enabling you to do things you could really never do before. So I think from that perspective, I would still give thanks. But you know, let's revisit it again next year and the year after and see what we think.
Yeah, and I think that's one area perhaps where we have seen some advances in marketing technology, isn't it, this year?
Yes,
perhaps with artificial intelligence. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about artificial intelligence engines that can create content. And there's a big buzz at the moment, isn't there, about images, about them creating images and content. So you can certainly see that. And I agree with you. I think thanks to artificial intelligence, but a cautious thanks, because we're not really sure what this gift is going to give, right, next year.
So let's
go with thanks to artificial intelligence. And then finally, because we're running out of time as usual, the proliferation of podcasts. Now, I know this isn't really a thing that's happened necessarily over this last year, but it's certainly something that is, it's a growing trend. So do you give thanks or no thanks to podcasts?
We're on a podcast. I guess I have to give thanks for a podcast. It is a great medium for getting out longer form content in a way that's easy for people to consume. So from that perspective, I give thanks to it. I mean, there are certainly a number of areas, not just in marketing, where I have a list of regular podcasts podcasters that I listen to. The one thing is, you said with the proliferation, as you said, everything can get kind of watered down. You know, you get noise, and how do you discern the stuff that has real value from the noise? And so, you know, that's up to the listeners. And I mean, I guess one of the challenges with it being so, and you could probably comment on this better than I can, it's relatively easy to get into the business of podcasting. Yeah. So, you know, so therefore everybody gets in on it, and, you know, do you get to the point where you really can't discern the quality from...
Wow. I think there's a discoverability problem. Yeah, there's a discoverability problem with podcasts. And one of the great things is there isn't a gate to owning your own media channel these days, right? It's the same with writing a blog or anything like that. And that's a great thing. You know, the democratization of media in that way is great. And I agree with you that, I mean, maybe the listeners would argue, you know, it is hard to find quality content sometimes, even on this podcast. So,
but that's where you got to, typically, you know, you go to either people who recommend, it's like lots of purchasing, you know. Oh, you know, get referrals or go to media you trust, and then see, oh, they have like the New York Times or the, you know, Guardian or whatever, you know, they've got podcasts that, you know, get into specific topics. And it's like, you know, and then, you know, you find out that somebody from a, you know, who has their own podcast is on somebody else's podcast. And then you say, oh, I'd like to go listen to that now. Yeah. So,
but also I think that's why if you have a podcast, you've got to hit it out of the park, really. And I think the first 20 minutes of this show. Now, and I want to give thanks to podcasts because there are a number of podcasts that I depend on almost for my marketing intelligence these days. So I think podcasts are an absolute thanks for me.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So that was our little game, our quick fire. I can't even say those words without laughing.
Rapid fire.
Yeah, we don't do anything quick, mate. Thanks or no thanks. I think that'll become a traditional parlor game in every Thanksgiving household from this point onwards.
Awesome.
So there's one last thing on the agenda what song are we going to play out with, Jeff?
Yeah. Well, it's my favorite thank you song. I know it's you know, it predates my my music listening experience, but Sly and the Family Stone, 1970, had "Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again," a nice upbeat rapid fire tune to go along with this, and then we can thank ourselves for all of these things we discussed for being good marketers.
Splendid. Well, I'll play out with that, and thank you, Jeff, again for being on the show. And will I be welcomed back into the studio next week?
Yeah, I'll have to listen to this episode and see if I'll let you back in.
Yeah, whether we think this whole podcasting thing's a good idea or not.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Mate. I'll see you then. Thank you very much.
See ya.
Good luck.
Bye bye.
Good luck to the USA, I guess.
Thank you. I would say good luck to England, but. All right, may the best team win. Maybe.
Yes, that's probably the best thing. Thank you, Jeff. And that was Sly and the Family Stone. Thank you for letting me be myself again from 1970. Let us know what you think. What in marketing would you give thanks for? You can find us at Rockstar CMO on LinkedIn or contact us through our website, rockstarcmo.com. Right, it's time for me to go backstage with this week's guest, Elisa Grucock. As you'll hear, Elisa has had a fantastic career as a marketing leader and analyst, most recently as Senior Vice President at Agent 3, and before that as a VP Principal Analyst at Forrester Research, where Elisa was responsible for helping hundreds of companies to build, execute, and optimize their account-based marketing strategies. Prior to Forrester, she spent over 20 years on the client side in field marketing roles at HP, Cisco, and Informatica, where she worked closely with sales to execute key account programs. It was fun to chat with Elisa. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Hi, Elisa. Welcome to Rockstar CMO FM. How are you?
I am doing well. Thanks.
It's great to have you on the show. And whereabouts are we speaking to you from?
From San Francisco.
Lovely.
California.
Yeah, another West Coast guest. I have a few West Coast guests. Normally, then I ask about the weather, but the weather is just dark and miserable here, so I'll probably gloss right over that. And for the listeners that don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I like to kind of answer that question by kind of talking about what I'm most passionate about. And I would say that's kind of corralling, an ambiguous set of marketing needs, putting a roadmap in place with clients. Using kind of structured processes, tools, and templates, and then making sure that, really awesome strategic campaigns get out the door. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I love to do. And, how did I get there? How did I get to kind of that, being passionate about doing that? I think about it in kind of two different ways. There was a part of my career that was spent in pretty big companies, 10 years at HP, 5 years at Cisco, 2 years at Informatica, where I was, a marketing practitioner, a manager, a leader doing, solutions marketing and demand gen and all those kinds of things. And I enjoyed that. What I found myself doing constantly was sort of asking, hey, is there a better way to do this? Is there a more innovative, structured way that we can be doing this better and do this more scalably? And so at some point I thought, why don't I just go sort of do that as a career, right? Why don't I go into a role where I'm actually working with marketing organizations to do things better and research best practices and publish those? And that's sort of what led me to serious decisions. And I had 5.5 great years there. I worked with hundreds of clients, thousands of inquiries over the years that I was there, but also had the room to kind of feed off of my colleagues and my peers, to sort of look at different parts of marketing that I hadn't necessarily done in my own practitioner career.
Yeah.
There were areas I'd gone very deep as a solutions demand gen, ABM person, starting HP's first account-based marketing program, you know. And then there were areas that my colleagues were really expert at that were not areas that I necessarily had expertise in, but I was able to kind of blend those together. Yeah. And that kind of led to a place of, sometimes I refer to myself as sort of like almost like an emergency room doctor, you know, standing at the front doors and clients come and it's like, tell me what you got going on. We're going to diagnose it.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen this problem before. I've probably seen whatever problems you have before in some form or fashion. So let's figure out a path forward and help you get some really good campaigns out the door. So
I love that. And as an analyst or working for an organization like Serious Decisions, it's great to have that headspace, isn't it? Where you can start to really think deep, get off the hamster wheel, as it were, or the merry-go-round of, and really think about some of these things, isn't it? Yeah. So it's great.
Totally.
And before that, I mean, you had a fabulous marketing career. You touched on there starting at HP. What inspired you to choose marketing as a career in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I studied marketing in business school, and the reason that I did, and the reason I wanted my first, you know, roles coming out of, you know, graduate school to be in marketing is I just really love the psychological aspects of it.
Right.
So really thinking about, you know, why customers need to get certain things done, what their pain points are, how do you kind of put a message that sort of speaks to those pain points and are going to help somebody do their job better, right? There's a kind of a diving in and an understanding of maybe their psychology, their behaviors, insights about how people want to do their jobs better. And then sort of activating that by saying, okay, here's a product or solution that we have, putting the right messaging together. We're going to reach you in the watering holes that you go to, right? We're going to understand those watering holes, and then we're going to get you the right thing in those watering holes to help solve a problem. I think that's kind of the heart of really good marketing. And that's what sort of brought me to marketing in the first place.
Yeah. And that started with HP, right?
Yeah. So I started in a solutions marketing role at HP. I've also had roles in my career where I was doing customer marketing, kind of customer advocacy and customer storytelling. And I really love that as well, because then you get to see that sort of process of having sold or marketed something to somebody to solve a business problem. But then you're going and kind of telling that whole story about not only the problem that was solved, but also, you know, kind of the results that came as a result of that. Customer storytelling is something I'm really passionate about as well. And I've done a lot of customer case studies and references. In fact, I ran the Program of the Year Awards at Serious Decisions. I was always the one that raised my hand to do those sessions at the Serious Decisions Summit and the Forrester Summit, because I love interviewing clients that are really doing amazing, innovative things and sort of saying, okay, tell me what it was like when you got to that job or when you started, you know, then tell me the steps that you took in those structured ways and then how it got better. And then like how you got those amazing results. I love telling those stories.
Yeah. I like that. And I like that idea of talking to customers and talking them through the entire journey. Whereas when you're like me, I'm a B2B tech CMO, and we tend to tell our customer stories like there was a problem, then magic happened and everything was solved. And that story in the middle is the important story if you want people to learn, other marketers to learn that journey, don't you? So it's important that folks like Forrester Serious Decisions tell that story so that us marketers can see what that journey actually was, right?
Well, and some of the mistakes they may have made along the way and how they course corrected is almost as important as the things that they did well, because there are so many common ways that organizations sort of go off the road, if you will. And knowing how to avoid those and course correct from those is almost as important as the things that you do right.
Yeah. And talking of off the road and course correct, I better get back onto the topic I wanted to ask you about, which was ABM. Because what I love about your career is you talk about doing ABM way before it was cool, right? when you're at HP. So how did that start? How did you get introduced to ABM? And sorry, I should say account-based marketing for people that aren't B2B nerds. What was it that started with you back then?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was telling you before the show started that it was a bit of a fluke. I was at a town hall meeting as part of the HP services organization, and I had just gone through kind of a transformational project. Peppers and Rogers, who kind of started this whole trend that they called one-to-one marketing, which we still have clients that call it that. But things have evolved a lot since then, a lot. But Peppers and Rogers came in and they did a whole speech. And then at the end of that meeting, the VP of my group at the time kind of pointed to me and said, Alisa, pilot, go, right?
Yeah.
And it was fun. I ended up with a virtual team of about 5 folks in field marketing, and we had 22 accounts in the program, and I had, you know, General Motors and Ford Motor Company as a couple of my accounts, and I was on a plane to Dearborn, Michigan, you know, every quarter working, you know, as an embedded member of the sales team. And we still have clients that do some of that today, but less and less as time goes on, because it's just really resource intensive and there's a lot of automation and scale that we now have available to us that we didn't have then.
Right.
So that's how I kind of got my introduction to it. And then I moved on to other kinds of roles and other things, as I've mentioned, demand gen, solutions marketing, customer marketing, and a lot of other things. But I always had that ABM thing kind of in the back of my mind, and ended up kind of looping back around to it.
Yeah. So 2 points on that. What I love is the way you describe being given the role, right, and getting a virtual team. I remember in the early days of doing content marketing, and similar thing happened, you know, I put my hand up, and then it was like, okay, well, you've got part of that person, a bit of that person, there's a virtual team. And it was like the good, bad, and the ugly, go do it, right? So, and then then, like you say, you came back to ABM as you continue to bang that drum at Forrester, or Serious Decision at Forrester. Now, Jeff Clark, who you know, because he's our mutual friend, and he's on the show, and we've discussed ABM quite a few times, and we just think it's just good B2B marketing practice. What do you think? Where do you think the state of ABM is today?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, Jeff and I co-published some research together, and so yes, we're dear colleagues and friends. I completely agree with that assessment. Mm-hmm. I think that calling that out is really important. That I think ABM really is just better targeted marketing. I really agree with that. And the reason I think it's very important to call that out is a lot of folks think that they can sort of declare that they're like, quote unquote, doing ABM, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't really know what that means, you know? So they'll hire somebody in to kind of be the head of ABM or to set up a global, you know, ABM center of excellence or something like that. And they think that setting up an ABM initiative is just going to sort of be the silver bullet that's going to kind of solve all of their marketing problems. And of course, that's just not the case, right?
Yeah.
It's more about, in my perspective, about changing your DNA, right? Mm-hmm. As a marketing and selling organization. It's really about moving a whole ecosystem to something that's better, and better being more targeted, right? So, I'm really in agreement that that's true. What I don't want people to take away from those comments, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying you shouldn't declare that changes are needed and be really prescriptive about it, because I think you should. You need to be systematic. You need to be thoughtful about kind of making your B2B marketing better. And I think you need a structured roadmap to do that. So I'm a really big believer in structured roadmaps, but I don't really care what you call it. In fact, I would encourage people not to call it ABM or ABX.
That was going to be my next question. What I was going to ask you was, I mean, one of the things that me and Jeff often discuss is, you know, we'll talk about our swimming pool in a minute, but one of the things that we talk about is, you know, should ABM still exist? It's almost like saying digital marketing, you know, like in B2B, ABM just is marketing, right? That's just how you do it. So you would encourage people not to say, I'm starting ABM initiative then.
I'm not sure that I would, you know, die on the hill of saying that you should call something something or not call something something. I don't really care. But what I think the danger that I've often seen with my clients that I want people to avoid is declaring a kind of a team over here somewhere that somehow on their own. And oftentimes those teams may not be senior enough to really create the changes that they need to be making to get marketing and sales really adopting a whole new DNA. That's a really big challenge, right? So if you've been hired on to quote unquote do ABM, but you don't really have those relationships in place to actually get that change done, you can be not set up for success. So that's the danger of it. I'm not saying you can't call it ABM or you shouldn't. I mean, particularly in very big companies that have an ABM center of excellence, sometimes those organizations, and when they focus on existing customers and it's more of a CSAT and retention play, right, I think that can be very successful.
Right.
But when you are, you know, I think you have to just be careful with those labels and what expectations come along with labels.
Yeah, to me, that sounds like commitment and experiments, right? Is that sometimes whatever the new marketing buzz is, a little team will be created in order to, let's try this ABM thing, but they're not really empowered to make something as significant as ABM to make that input on impact on the rest of the organization. I think that's what you're saying, right?
So, I mean, there are some things that I encourage every client to do. I don't care what they call it, but there's some, like, there are three things that I encourage every client to do, almost irrespective of what their product is, what their sales cycle is. You know, doesn't really matter. One is a maturity assessment, right?
Yeah.
So, taking a kind of a comprehensive and honest look at your ability to be more targeted, call it ABM, call it something else, but your ability to be more targeted, can you do paid media to your targets, right? Yeah. In a way that's cost effective? Can you recognize when an account or a buying group is showing buying signals? Are you able to do that? Once those signals are recognized, you have marketing motions and you have content, you know, to kind of effectively reach a whole buying group, not just one person who you declare as a quote unquote lead, right? Measurement and reporting, some of the areas that Jeff and I have worked on together. So you measure whether you're passing opportunities to sales with multiple members of a buying group within the accounts that are part of your ICP. So taking kind of an assessment of those things is something I think every organization should be doing. And maybe it's a rating system on it. You know, I've worked with clients on maturity assessments where it's like a rating system from 1 to 5. And then you lay out the things that are, you know, your pressing urgent things that, you know, you can, you know, your low hanging fruit that you can solve quickly. And then what are your knottier problems that need a roadmap over time? And then just start to triage those things out. It's a really important thing that's like a baseline for every organization.
Right. And I like that, because what you're saying is you're coming in and you're evaluating the whole marketing team with an ABM lens or a more targeted lens, if we do that, and how that team can then operate in that environment, rather than saying, why don't we stand up an ABM team over here and watch them fail and go, this ABM thing's not very good, is it?
Right. It's like giving people a gargantuan task and not having all of the resources to be able to do that. And kind of, okay, we've washed our hands clean of any changes we need to make over here in other parts of the organization, because we've named that ABM team over here.
Yeah.
And that's why, again, I'm wary of organizations that kind of set things up that way, because I don't think anyone's set up for success that way. So the maturity assessment's important. The other thing is having a very targeted, you know, go-to-market strategy. And I'll tell you what I mean by that, because that could mean a lot of things to different people. I think if you're a SaaS offering going after, you know, $10,000 deals, $10,000 in ARR for your first year, you need to do things at scale. You need to be automated. You need to rely a lot on tech. If you're Boeing and you're selling $50 million airplanes to no more than 200, you know, carriers, right? That's like a one-to-one. That's kind of the old school kind of stuff that I used to do at HP. And there's still a place for that. But most organizations are not at either of those extremes. They're not, right? Most organizations are somewhere in the middle. They're selling $50,000 deals. They're going after the mid-market with $75,000 to $100,000 deals. They're maybe landing with solutions that are $200,000 or $300,000 and have 6 month or 8 month sales cycles. That's sort of most organizations, and most of those organizations need a hybrid model,
right?
They need something that's a bit dynamic. They need to do some things at scale to get the market, you know, to find accounts and buying centers, teams or departments, and buying groups that are in market. They need to be able to identify who's in market. And that's a scale activity, right? That's a volume activity. And they need to find maybe in existing accounts, you know, new buying groups that are, you know, cross-selling and upselling. And that's that can be a scaled activity. But then they need to be able to respond and be dynamic to the signals that they're seeing and apply more, a little bit more customized content and a little more customized BDR touches and gather information about the whole buying group, mm-hmm. you know, in a more customized way, and then ultimately moving towards a sales cycle. That's a hybrid model. That's right. Not do we do ABM or do we not do ABM. That's doing some things at scale in an automated way to reach a broad market, and you know, and maybe you do digital, you know, account-based digital display as well. You tweak things and do a little bit more of an account-based thing, but it gets more account-centric and buyer group-centric as you get into
I think to your point, I mean, any of those techniques, if you know clearly the A in ABM that's your ideal, I mean, you used the acronym ICP, didn't you? If you know who it is that you're actually going after, even if you're going broad with your digital marketing and your ad spend, if you've got that in mind, that defines your copy, you know, you then start getting people self-selecting, don't you? So therefore, you're driving a broad ABM strategy, but at least you know who you're going after, right?
Exactly.
I also noticed, I mean, time is ticking by. This is fascinating. But I noticed while at Forrester, your research evolved into insights-driven targeting. Is that the new direction for ABM, or is that a new... Are us cool kids going to have to start going by IDT instead of ABM, or where's that going?
No, I see ICPs as like an integral part of what I'll call better B2B targeted marketing. I'm not going to use the word ABM for all the reasons that I explained earlier. Yeah, yeah. By the way, I did that research at Serious Decisions and ultimately at Forrester with a colleague named Robert Munoz, who I need to give a shout out to. He is my sales operations colleague because I'm a really big believer that marketing, you know, sales generally controls the selection of targets. And they do that because they own the territory and quota setting processes. We're not going to change that as marketers. We're not going to, you know, suddenly be in the territory and quota setting business. We're not. So we need to be partners. We need to be partners that show up with a perspective. We need to maybe even be key influencers of that targeting process, that ICP process. But at the end of the day, I always used to tell my clients, marketing leaders, like, go make that sales operations VP your best friend.
Yeah, because absolutely.
Those people have a ton of power. Power is not the right word. They have a ton of influence, and they have their fingers on the dials. Yeah. And the challenge with ICP is that there's a tension there between choosing firmographic ICP, so industry and company size and things like that, which is easy, but it's not very meaningful because then you end up with the same list as your competitors have. How do you get into organizations at the buying center level and the team or department level and find organizations that have more subtle factors where the data may not be, you know, as available, publicly available. And so working marketing and sales ops coming together to say what's possible for us from an ICP perspective, what data is available to us and how targeted can we get versus where it's going to cost too much money to get that data and we'll just live with the higher level firmographic stuff that we have. So I've written a lot about that and it's something I'm really passionate about, and it's not an easy thing to solve for.
I like it. All right, so we're up to time, and so insights driven targeting is something that people should look for in your work, I think we've done ABM. They're very good. So I'm going to get to our final question. We have a regular feature, the Rockstar CMO Swimming Pool, our portal to marketing hell, where we throw all the bullshit, snake oil, and overhyped trends that plague this industry we love. What would you chuck in?
I would just chuck in the importance of when you buy new technologies that you're really clear that you have the systems and processes in place. I'm sure other people have probably said that exact same thing, but intent is a perfect example, really supportive of intent. I think it's great for reading buying signals, but if you're sending a whole bunch of intent data over to your SDRs and it's not packaged up in a way that they can digest, you're going to be in trouble. So I don't think it's snake oil or anything like that. Quite to the contrary, I'm really supportive of those kinds of technologies, but make sure you've got the processes and systems and tools and incentives for people to be successful with those things.
I like that one. And it's interesting because I often talk to marketing tech CMOs, and a lot of them want to throw technology into the swimming pool as well because it's such a thorny topic. But I like the nuance that you put on it, which is that, you know, it's not thought through technology that you want to go in the pool. It's not technology itself, right? So that's great.
No, not at all. Yeah, not at all. Yeah, yeah. But all right. It's being knowing what you can digest and what you can't.
Yeah, right? I like that. I like that. So that's been great. Thank you very much. We're out of time. When people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, Elisa?
I think the best place to find me is on good old LinkedIn. Just look me up, find my profile, and reach out to me. Happy to hear from folks.
Excellent. I will obviously include all your links in the show notes, and I look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian. Good. Great conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Elisa. And if you're interested in any of the topics we discussed, I really recommend getting in touch with Elisa, a really smart marketer. And as you heard, you can find her on LinkedIn, and I will include all of her links in the show notes, which you can find at rockstarcmo.com. Right, it's time to wind down this Thanksgiving week in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and be transported away for a cocktail and a marketing thought with my friend and content marketing guru, Robert Rose. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, hello, my friend, and welcome to the end of a short week for us here in the U.S. with U.S. Thanksgiving, or as you all call it, Thursday.
We're going to have Black Friday, though.
So. Yeah, you do. Well, you have sadly that sort of virus has spread across the planet. Much to my dismay, I've always hated Black Friday as an idea. And some of our friends, I would say, the people you and I both know, are loyalists to the Black Friday idea. I mean, without naming names, they get up, their whole family gets up at 5 a.m. They get donuts and coffee, and they go camp out and, basically get into these lines. It's absolute insanity to me, but they love it. I can't understand it.
No, I don't either. But anyway, we've managed to survive are you a big turkey guy? Is it one of the holidays you like?
It is. I love to cook, although interestingly, we sort of switch off from year to year of whether I love to cook Thanksgiving meals. Yeah. I love doing the turkey. I love doing the potatoes and the vegetables and the whole ritual. I love the whole thing. Yeah. But this year there's just going to be a small number of us. There's only three of us.
Yeah.
And so we're going to go do the restaurant thing, which is, just as lovely, but it's and lots easier, obviously. But yeah, it does take a little bit away from it. I really enjoy the sort of all day snacking and eating. And, by the time you get to dinner, you're not hungry at all, but you sort of and you're drunk, by the way, with all the cocktails that you've consumed. And then I love watching football, obviously, during the day. So
yes,
it's going to be lovely nonetheless. And I'm happy about it. And so in any event, so we're celebrating this as this goes live in the virtual bar. Yeah. But we do have a wonderful celebration of Thanksgiving, U.S. Thanksgiving, for a Thanksgiving martini that we'll be drinking tonight. And that is this is not a classic martini, because I believe in the classic martini is gin, but okay.
I've come to
accept that vodka is a viable alternative to a martini.
Uh-huh.
And so you have a vodka martini, straight up, with a, now this is the cool part and a little difficult to find sometimes, a Malabar spiced liqueur. So Malabar, if you're not familiar with it, is like a cinnamon spice sort of liqueur.
Yeah.
And then you add to that a little bit of cranberry juice, and you have yourself a beautiful, wonderful Thanksgiving martini. Maybe you throw a cinnamon stick in there just for a little bit, but that's gonna look it's great. It's a wonderful martini.
Yeah, and that's gonna look really classy and great for the season when the cinnamon stick sticking out of it. That sounds fantastic. No olives and no dirtiness there. That seems to be quite a sensible drink.
No, it's actually a sweeter because of the Malabar liqueur. It's a bit of a sweeter martini, a little bit more like a Cosmo or something like that.
And is that shaken? Presumably. martini?
You know, typically, yes. You can stir it as well, but shaken is preferred.
Very good. Well, I'm going to attempt to make that very drink using only the ingredients on my desktop bar. So I've started off with a bit of ice. I don't have my shaker on my desktop bar, unfortunately. And I'm going to agree with you about this.
Have you ever had a shaker in your bar?
I did a martini once. Just out of curiosity. We did that for a special occasion.
Okay.
Do you remember? Because my olive had an anchovy in it and you thought that was filthy.
That's right. That is just as nasty as it comes. Yeah, that's just absolutely gross.
Well, yeah. I'm going to go with your preferred base for a martini. And I have got Hendrick's gin. This time I've got the Neptunia gin. Today, so I'm going to stick some of that in there. And then you said I wrote these down. So that there's that Malabar spice liqueur and cranberry juice. Let me just have a search, and I found the quintessential English cranberry, which of course is the cucumber, and the lovely people at Fever Tree have put some of that into some tonic.
Which is nice.
I'm going to have quite a long gin tonic. Yes.
That is absolutely none of the ingredients, but it is absolutely going to be fine.
Peculiar enough, I don't have a cinnamon stick on my desk either, but I could have a bit of cucumber. But
a pencil might work. That would be the most English of
cinnamon sticks. Let me try this.
A pencil. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I've actually put so much gin in that, that's almost like a martini.
There you go. It is a little later yes.
But that's indeed fantastic. Thank you. So this is delicious. I could probably drink one of these every week. And what are we calling this?
I suspect you might. Yeah, we're calling this the Thanksgiving Martini in celebration for U.S. Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. And actually, Robert, as it is the season of giving thanks, thank you very much for the God knows how many weeks you've been in the bar with me and put up with this rubbish. So thank you very much. For that.
It's absolutely a pleasure always to be here. And for our travels, we will be home for Thanksgiving. So
perfect.
Because this is merely the weekend for you,
yes,
and Thursday was just Thursday, I'd have you over to my home where we would celebrate American Thanksgiving here. Uh-huh. You could hang out with me and we'd sit on the beach and have some Thanksgiving martinis until we, pass out.
Nice.
Watching football.
Yeah, go Cowboys.
Yes.
Yes. And but imagine if all that stuff wasn't happening and we just happened to be... happen to be chatting about marketing, what would be our Thanksgiving thought from a marketing perspective?
You know, it's something that I have realized, and we mm-hmm. talked about it on this show, I don't know how long ago it was. It was a months ago, I would say, mm-hmm. that we talked about this. It came out of a workshop that I did recently, and it's about finding good, compelling stories in some of the most boring content that we create. And what I mean by that is that, so as marketers, mm-hmm. And I mean general marketers here, we are, you know, we create all kinds of things, right? We create ebooks and mm-hmm. thought leadership, white papers and entertaining videos and fun customer stories. And all of those are sort of baked into all of those things are elements of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so we try and make them, and when we do it, most importantly, we're excited about doing it.
Yeah.
And we're excited about creating these things because there's an element, or at least the perception of an element, of super creativity in it. And then there are the more process-oriented pieces that we have to create, like standards or guidelines or how-to instructions, or, you know, any initiative that has to relay sort of information out to a bunch of people. And these are necessary, certainly. They're constructed pieces, but they're very rarely considered to be a place where we can sort of stretch our creative storytelling mm-hmm. legs. And in the discussion we had a few months ago, and I've written on this before,
yeah.
There's a quote, and it's on my desk. I love this quote so much. And it comes from G.K. Chesterton's critique of the Dickens novel, The Pickwick Papers. Mm-hmm. And what he says in the critique, and this is the quote that's on my desk, is he says, the whole difference between construction and creation is exactly this, that a thing constructed can only be loved after it's constructed, but a thing created is loved before it exists. And this resonates with me so much as a content creator, because the excitement of creating that story, that customer story, that thought leadership piece during the creation of it is the thing that you love. You love it even before it comes to its fruition. Yeah. But when we construct those things like standards and guidelines, we can be satisfied after they're done because they're useful or they have utility, et cetera. But we don't get excited during the creation process because it is constructed. We can only love it after it's actually been done.
Right.
And when we talked before, and the thing that I wrote about was that obviously most content creators prefer the former, right? Mm-hmm. They prefer the storytelling, fun, thought leadership stuff. And my point in our discussion and the thing that I wrote was I said, all writers write, but not all writing is writing. And I've never met any content creator that's happy only doing constructing content as their sole activity, right? So I think back to technical writers. Who write technical documents and are satisfied, but they also really love creating. And they're never, you know, so the opportunity, I said, is that as a leader in your business, make sure that your content creators have the ability to do both, right? They have the ability to do the creation stuff, but they have the responsibility on occasion to do the construction stuff. That keeps people happy and creative in their work. And I missed something there. And what I missed, and this is what I learned in my wonderful workshop here, is that I missed the nuance that you can actually bring creation to the construction. In other words, what I should have said at the end of that piece was all writers write and not all writing is writing, but it can be. Wow. And in other words, what I mean by that is, and to put it into context of this workshop that I had, which was a storytelling workshop where we were sort of working with, you know, practitioners in this company trying to do things like, you know, customer stories and case studies and press releases and, you know, all sorts of marketing materials and bringing structural elements of storytelling to make it a little better, to make it a little more fulfilling as an emotional story. And one of the content practitioners submitted, as an example, a process document. And it happened to be this process document of discussing how and when and where content gets deleted from the company intranet. And I loved it. It was, you know, it was so dry to start with. It was so boring to start with.
Yeah.
But it was so much fun to try and figure out how to make it a more fulfilling story.
Right.
And so we did. We went in and we started looking for the tension and we started looking for the lessons and trying to sell not only the, you know, lay out the process in a logical fashion, but to sell it. And basically, you know, sell it in a way that made it emotional and full of adventures and tension and basically make it more of a thought leadership piece, make a process document more of a thought leadership piece. Wow. And we use this process that I won't bore you with all of the details. You can sort of find it if you're interested in the more depth. But the real sort of lever here was that you can find exciting stories because only time will tell whether that piece would be great or more readily accepted or more read or more valued by the audience. But that wasn't my point. My point was for the content creators who had to create this intranet document, they were more excited about creating it. They were happier in their jobs creating it. And that, if anything else, certainly won't make the piece less interesting, right? If they bring that energy to it. So that was the big win for me, was that they were excited in creating this piece. And hopefully it'll be a better piece because of
that. And I think that I love that. I love that idea, and especially the example that you use, which is such a dry idea. But between that and the most creative piece of content you might create, there's a huge sort of spectrum, isn't there, of content you might create. And sometimes people write press releases or write, you know, in a very formulaic way, in a joyless way, in a joyless process, right? But you could apply that to any kind of content we create. I mean, if you can apply it to internet guidelines, then presumably you could apply it to anything.
Well, that's the idea, right? Is that, you know, certainly it's not appropriate, you know, that much effort is not appropriate for everything we create. But it's probably more appropriate than we allow for most of the time, right? You know, in other words, you get the assignment to write some process paper or the guidelines or standards or something that literally has to be like a street sign, right? Which is all it's meant to do is convey some information. And normally, you know, it, like you said, it can be a joyless job. It's just, you know, it's literally trying to write. It's like trying to find the story in a recipe for soup, right? And, you know, and there is, if you think about it, I could write a recipe for soup that is quite literally a list of ingredients and a how-to and has zero emotion in it or zero, you know, but it's very useful, right? It's a utility and useful set of information. Or I can write that recipe for soup in a story. And, you know, there is a use case for both of those things. One of them is much more joyful to write. And so when appropriate, let's not default to the recipe that simply is a street sign and a conveyance of information. Perhaps let's think about how we can really find joy and magic and fun in the thing that we have to create.
And, I mean, I like your focus there on the person doing the creating, because then obviously the content will be better, not just on the reading. And of course, you know, we talked about how, you know, when you do search for a recipe, you get all sorts of crap. What did you call the kind of content? But, you know, that stuff can't get in the way of the utility if somebody really needs the utility element of it, right? But knowing the story could help a different reader go, huh, that's why we need to do it this way, right? Like, you know, I don't know, like if you're telling the story about why somebody should archive stuff off the intranet. You're not just saying, after 3 weeks, do this. You're saying, because of something that happened before or my experience, it's best if we do this. I wasn't in
that's
your
right.
workshop.
Yeah, it's you know, and in that particular, it's a great point, because in that particular case, what we discovered was, you know, so the whole process behind this intranet thing was, you know, and we discovered this in having this sort of, you know, dialogue to sort of find the structural story elements in it, because what I wanted to find was the tension, right? The tension always gets you to a why, you know, why this is important and what's emotionally important for me to understand about this particular instruction. So it's to find that in motion, you can go into what's the tension. And I said, what's your point, right? What's the point of the whole thing? And the point of the whole thing was, well, we want to create the impression with this audience that, you know, deleting content out of the internet is important, because there's an inverse relationship between outdated and, you know, inaccurate content and the usefulness of the internet as whole. And I said, yes, that's totally a valid point. I said, now what's the opposition to that? Like, what's the tension of that? And the tension to it, as it turns out, is that people read that and go, ah, it's everybody except me, right? This doesn't apply to me, right? If everybody else does it, I'll be good. And of course, the real why they wanted to say this in this particular way, in other words, why is this process important, is because what they're saying in the process is, no, we're deleting all content after a certain time period unless you go in and say it shouldn't be deleted. And so the idea there is to address that specific tension to say, no, we're not asking you to go in and delete stuff and keep it timely. We're asking you to go in and actually tell us if it's something shouldn't be deleted. And the reason why is blah, 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 blah. And this is the tension, and this is why this is important. And your role in it is incredibly, you know, important to keep the intranet useful and functional for the institution, and really sell them on this idea and why this is important and make it emotional. And that made it much better, much, much more powerful in terms of what, you know, now when you say step one is this, step two is this, you know, watch your email, you know, you have to react to it. You know, there'll be a poll and a survey saying, can I delete this? Blah, blah, blah. You get, theoretically, you get people much more engaged in that process.
Stories sell, right? And that's the whole point, is that you're just telling a small story to help somebody and do the thing you want, and are offering the why. I really like that. So you said that you'd written about this. Whereabouts would you might have written about this?
Well, I write a lot, you know. I write a lot just about everywhere. The whole the, I think there's some segment of the web that is just me, actually.
Where would you find that?
No, I've written about this on Content Marketing Institute's blog, for sure. I've written about it on our own website, which, of course, is contentadvisory.net. And then occasionally, you know, elsewhere. But this is these are the two main points for this one.
Good. All right. Well, I'll include links to those in the show notes. And when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you?
Well, we'll see what happens with this whole Twitter nonsense. But I actually am on Mastodon these days. And if anybody else is on Mastodon, would love to connect with you there, just trying it out, seeing what's going on. The Mastodon handles are unfortunately a little longer, but I'm at RR at experienceadvisors.io. And so that's, you know, you can find me there. I'm also on LinkedIn, still working on LinkedIn. And, I'm an easy search away for there.
Splendid. Yes. And I'll just plug the fact that I'm also on your little Mastodon server too. And I'm 3Ts at the same location. And I'll include links to that too in the show notes. We are both on Mastodon.
Brilliant.
All right, mate. Brilliant. And most importantly, though, apart from being on Mastodon, will you be in the bar next week?
Of course. We'll be done with our Thanksgiving holiday and getting prepped for Christmas. Love and it. Here we go.
All right. Well, have a great one, mate. I'll speak to you then. Thank you, Robert. And that reminded me of some fun workshops I've had with Robert in the past. I recommend getting him in to chat with your team. So that's a wrap on episode 142 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. Thanks to Jeff, Alisa, and Robert for sharing their insight. But thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track, and jiving along with us. So what do you think? Does the world need another Effing Marketing Podcast? How about dropping us a little thanks with a rating or review in your favourite podcast? I'm glad you're here. Next week, Jeff will be back in the studio. Executive coach Richard Medcalf returns for a chat about his book. And Robert will be back in our virtual bar. Until then, have a great week. And I hope you'll join us again here next week.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.